on the other. By now, the Lord's declarant might have climbed as far as snow. It took most of a day to make the climb, even on muleback. Afoot, most men took several days. It might be that the Lords would talk late into the night. They would need fresh candles. After Maddie laid the fire, she sent her down to find the scented beeswax candles Lord Waxley had given Lady Lysa when he sought to win her hand. Then she visited the kitchens once again to make certain of the wine and bread. All seemed well in hand, and there was still time enough for her to bathe and wash her hair and change. There was a gown of purple silk that gave her pause, and another of dark blue velvet slashed with silver that would have woken all the colour in her eyes. But in the end, she remembered that Elaine was, after all, a bastard, and must not presume to dress above her station. The dress she picked was lamb's wool, dark brown and simply cut, with leaves and vines embroidered around the bodice, sleeves and hem in golden thread. It was modest and becoming, though scarce richer than something a serving girl might wear. Peter had given her all of Lady Lysa's jewels as well, and she tried on several necklaces, but they all seemed ostentatious. In the end, she chose a simple velvet ribbon in autumn gold. When Gretchel fetched her Lysa's silvered looking-glass, the colour seemed just perfect with Elaine's mass of dark brown hair. "Lord Royce will never know me," she thought. "Why, I hardly know myself." Feeling near as bold as Peter Baelish, Elaine Stone donned her smile and went down to meet their guests. The Eyrie was the only castle in the Seven Kingdoms where the main entrance was underneath the dungeons. Steep stone steps crept up the mountainside past the way castles, stone and snow, but they came to an end at Sky. The final 600 feet of the ascent were vertical, forcing would-be visitors to dismount their mules and make a choice. They could ride the swaying wooden basket that was used to lift supplies, or clamber up a rocky chimney using handholds carved into the rock. Lord Redfort and Lady Wainwood, the most elderly of the Lord's declarant, chose to be drawn up by the winch, after which the basket was lowered once more for fat Lord Belmore. The other lords made the climb. Elaine met them in the crescent chamber beside a warming fire, where she welcomed them in Lord Robert's name and served them bread and cheese and cups of hot mulled wine in silver cups. Peter had given her a roll of arms to study, so she knew their heraldry, if not their faces. The Red Castle was Redfort, plainly, a short man with a neat grey beard and mild eyes. Lady Anya was the only woman amongst the Lord's declarant and wore a deep green mantle with the broken wheel of Wainwood picked out in beads of jet. 6 silver bells on purple, that was Belmore, pear-bellied and round of shoulder. His beard was a ginger-grey horror sprouting from a multiplicity of chins. Simon Templeton's, by contrast, was black and sharply pointed. A beak of a nose and icy blue eyes made the Knight of 9 Stars look like some elegant bird of prey. His doublet displayed 9 black stars within a golden saltire. Young Lord Hunter's ermine cloak confused her till she spied the brooch that pinned it, 5 silver arrows fanned. Elaine would have put his age closer to 50 than to 40. His father had ruled at Longbow Hall for nigh on 60 years, only to die so abruptly that some whispered the new lord had hastened his inheritance. Hunter's cheeks and nose were red as apples, which bespoke a certain fondness for the grape. She made certain to fill his cup as often as he emptied it. The youngest man in the party had 3 ravens on his chest, each clutching a blood-red heart in its talons. His brown hair was shoulder-length, 1 stray lock curled down across his forehead. Sir Lynn Corbray, Elaine thought with a wary glance at his hard mouth and restless eyes. Last of all came the Royces, Lord Nestor and Bronze Yeon. The Lord of Runestone stood as tall as the Hound. Though his hair was grey and his face lined, Lord Yeon still looked as though he could break most younger men like twigs in those huge, gnarled hands. His seamed and solemn face brought back all of Sansa's memories of his time at Winterfell. She remembered him at table speaking quietly with her mother. She heard his voice booming off the walls when he rode back from a hunt with a buck behind his saddle. She could see him in the yard, a practice sword in hand, hammering her father to the ground and turning to defeat Sir Roderick as well. "He will know me. How could he not?" She considered throwing herself at his feet to beg for his protection. He never fought for Rob. Why should he fight for me? The war is finished and Winterfell is fallen. "Lord Royce," she asked timidly, "will you have a cup of wine to take the chill off?" Bronze Yone had slate-gray eyes, half hidden beneath the bushiest eyebrows she had ever seen. They crinkled when he looked down at her. "Do I know you, girl?" Elaine felt as though she had swallowed her tongue, but Lord Nestor rescued her. "Elaine is the Lord Protector's natural daughter," he told his cousin gruffly. "Littlefinger's little finger has been busy," said Lynn Corbray with a wicked smile. Belmore laughed, and Elaine could feel the color rising in her cheeks.
"How old are you, child?"
asked Lady Waynewood.
14, my lady."
For a moment she forgot how old Elaine should be.
"And I am no child, but a maiden flowered."
"But not deflowered, one can hope."
Young Lord Hunter's bushy moustache hid his mouth entirely.
"Yet," said Lynn Corbray, as if she were not there. "But ripe for plucking soon, I'd say."
"Is that what passes for courtesy at Hart's home?"
Anya Wainwood's hair was graying, and she had crow's feet around her eyes and loose skin beneath her chin, but there was no mistaking the air of nobility about her.
"The girl is young and gently bred and has suffered enough horrors. Mind your tongue, sir."
"My tongue is my concern," Corbray replied. "Your ladyship should take care to mind her own. I have never taken kindly to chastisement, as any number of dead men could tell you."
Lady Waynewood turned away from him.
"Best take us to your father, Elaine. The sooner we are done with this, the better."
"The Lord Protector awaits you in the Solar, if my lords would follow me."
From the Crescent Chamber they climbed a steep flight of marble steps that bypassed both Undercrofts and dungeons, and passed beneath three murder holes, which the Lord's Declarant pretended not to notice. Belmore was soon puffing like a bellows, and Redfort's face turned as grey as his hair. The guards atop the stairs raised the portcullis at their coming.
"This way, if it pleased my lords."
Elaine led them down the arcade, past a dozen splendid tapestries. Sir Lothar Brune stood outside the Solar. He opened the door for them and followed them inside. Peter was seated at the trestle table with a cup of wine to hand, looking over a crisp white parchment. He glanced up as the Lord's Declarant filed in.
"My lords, be welcome.
And you as well, my lady. The ascent is wearisome, I know. Please be seated, Elaine, my sweet. More wine for our noble guests."
"As you say, father."
The candles had been lighted, she was pleased to see. The Solar smelled of nutmeg and other costly spices. She went to fetch the flagon, whilst the visitors arranged themselves side by side, all save Nestor Royce, who hesitated before walking around the table to take the empty chair beside Lord Peter, and Lynn Corbray, who went to stand beside the hearth instead. The heart-shaped ruby in the pommel of his sword shone redly as he warmed his hands. Elaine saw him smile at Sir Lothar Brune. "Sir Lynn is very handsome for an older man," she thought, "but I do not like the way he smiles."
"I have been reading this remarkable declaration of yours," Peter began.
"Splendid! Whatever maester wrote this has a gift for words. I only wish you had invited me to sign as well." That took them unawares.
"You?" said Belmore. "Sign?"
"I wield a quill as well as any man, and no one loves Lord Robert more than I do. As for these false friends and evil counselors, by all means let us root them out. My lords, I am with you heart and hand. Show me where to sign, I beg you."
Elaine Poring heard Lynn Corbray chuckle. The others seemed at a loss till Bronze Yone Royce cracked his knuckles and said,
"We did not come for your signature. nor do we mean to bandy words with you, Littlefinger. What a pity. I do so love a nicely bandied word. Peter set the parchment to one side. As you wish. Let us be blunt. What would you have of me, my lords and lady?
We will have naught of you.
Simon Templeton fixed the Lord Protector with his cold blue stare. We will have you gone.
Gone?
Peter feigned surprise. Where would I go?
The crown has made you Lord of Harrenhal,
young Lord Hunter pointed out. That should be enough for any man.
The Riverlands have need of a lord,
old Horton Redford said.
River Run stands besieged. Bracken and Blackwood are at open war, and outlaws roam freely on both sides of the Trident, stealing and killing as they will. Unburied corpses litter the landscape everywhere you go.
You make it sound so wonderfully attractive, Lord Redfort, Peter answered. But as it happens, I have pressing duties here, and there is Lord Robert to consider. Would you have me drag a sickly child into the midst of such carnage?
His lordship will remain in the Vale, declared Yeon Royce. I mean to take the boy with me to Runestone, and raise him up to be a knight that John Allen would be proud of.
Why Runestone? Peter mused. Why not Iron Oaks or the Red Fort? Why not Longbow Hall?
Any of these would serve as well, declared Lord Belmore, and his lordship will visit each in turn in due time.
Will he?
Peter's tone seemed to hint at doubts. Lady Wainwood sighed. Lord Peter, if you think to set us one against the other, you may spare yourself the effort. We speak with one voice here. Runestone suits us all. Lord Yeon raised 3 fine sons of his own. There is no man more fit to foster his young lordship. Maester Helliwegg is a good deal older and more experienced than your own Maester Coleman, and better suited to treat Lord Robert's frailties. In Runestone, the boy will learn the arts of war from strong Sam Stone. No man could hope for a finer master at arms. Septon Lucas will instruct him in matters of the spirit. At Runestone he will also find other boys his own age, more suitable companions than the old women and sellswords that presently surround him. Peter Baelish fingered his beard. His lordship needs companions, I do not disagree. Elaine is hardly an old woman, though. Lord Robert loves my daughter dearly. He will be glad to tell you so himself. And as it happens, I have asked Lord Grafton and Lord Linderley to send me each a son to ward. Each of them has a boy of an age with Robert.
Lynn Corbray laughed. 2 pups from a pair of lapdogs.
Robert should have an older boy about him, too. A promising young squire, say. Someone he could admire and try to emulate. Peter turned to Lady Wainwood.
You have such a boy at Iron Oaks, my lady. Perhaps you might agree to send me Harold Harding.
Anya Wainwood seemed amused.
Lord Peter, you are as bold a thief as I'd ever care to meet.
I do not wish to steal the boy, said Peter, but he and Lord Robert should be friends.
Bronze Yeon Royce leaned forward. It is meet and proper that Lord Robert should befriend young Harry, and he shall, at Runestone under my care as my ward and squire.
Give us the boy, said Lord Belmore, and you may depart to the Vale unmolested for your proper seat at Harrenhal.
Peter gave him a look of mild reproach. Are you suggesting that elsewise I might come to harm, my lord? I cannot think why. My late wife seemed to think this was my proper seat.
Lord Baelish, Lady Wainwood said, Lysa Tully was John Arryn's widow and the mother of his child, and ruled here as his regent. You, let us be frank, are no Arryn, and Lord Robert is no blood of yours. By what right do you presume to rule us?
Lysa named me Lord Protector, I do seem to recall.
Young Lord Hunter said, Lysa Tully was never truly of the Vale, nor had she the right to dispose of us.
And Lord Robert?
Peter asked. Will your lordship also claim that Lady Lysa had no right to dispose of her own son?
Nestor Royce had been silent all this while, but now he spoke up loudly.
I once hoped to wed Lady Lysa myself, as did Lord Hunter's father and Lady Anya's son. Cobray scarce left her side for half a year. Had she chosen any one of us, no man here would dispute his right to be the Lord Protector. It happens that she chose Lord Littlefinger and entrusted her son to his care. He was John Arryn's son as well, cousin, Bronzione said, frowning at the keeper. He belongs to the Vale. Peter feigned puzzlement. The Eyrie is as much a part of the Vale as Runestone, unless someone has moved it. Jape all you like, Littlefinger, Lord Belmore blustered. The boy shall come with us.
I am loath to disappoint you, Lord Belmore, but my stepson will be remaining here with me. He is not a robust child, as all of you know well. The journey would tax him sorely. As his stepfather and Lord Protector, I cannot permit it.
Simon Templeton cleared his throat and said, Each of us has 1,000 men at the foot of this mountain, Littlefinger.
What a splendid place for them.
If need be, we can summon many more.
Are you threatening me with war, sir?
Peter did not sound the least afraid.
Bronzione said, We shall have Lord Robert.
For a moment it seemed as though they had come to an impasse, until Lynn Corbray turned from the fire.
All this talk makes me ill. Littlefinger will talk you out of your small clothes if you listen long enough. The only way to settle his sort is with steel.
He drew his long sword. Peter spread his hands.
I wear no sword, sir.
Easily remedied.
Candlelight rippled along the smoke-gray steel of Corbray's blade, so dark that it put Sansa in mind of Ice, her father's great sword.
Your apple-eater holds a blade? Tell him to give it to you, or draw that dagger.
She saw Lotho Broon reach for his own sword, but before the blades could meet, Bronzione rose in wrath.
Put up your steel, sir. Are you a Corbray or a Frey? We are guests here.
Lady Winwood pursed her lips and said, This is unseemly.
Sheathe your sword, Corbray,
young Lord Hunter echoed. You shame us all with this.
Come, Lynn, chided Redfort in a softer tone. This will serve for naught. Put Lady Forlorn to bed.
My lady has a thirst, Sir Lynn insisted. Whenever she comes out to dance, she likes a drop of red.
Your lady must go thirsty.
Bronzione put himself squarely in Corbray's path.
The Lord's declarant, Lynn Corbray snorted. You should have named yourselves the six old women.
He slid the dark sword back into its scabbard and left them, shouldering Broon aside as if he were not there. Elaine listened to his footsteps recede. Anya Wainwood and Horton Redfoot exchanged a look. Hunter drained his wine cup and held it out to be refilled.
Lord Baelish, Sir Simon said, you must forgive us that display.
Must I? Littlefinger's voice had grown cold. You brought him here, my lords.
Bronzione said,
It was never our intent. You brought him here. I would be well within my rights to call my guards and have all of you arrested.
Hunter lurched to his feet so wildly that he almost knocked the flagon out of Elaine's hands.
You gave us safe conduct.
Yes, be grateful that I have more honor than some.
Peter sounded as angry as she had ever heard him. I have read your declaration and heard your demands. Now hear mine.
Remove your armies from this mountain. Go home and leave my son in peace. Misrule there has been, I will not deny it, but that was Lysa's work, not mine.
Grant me but a year, and with Lord Nestor's help I promise that none of you shall have any cause for grievance.
So you say, said Belmore, yet how shall we trust you?
You dare call me untrustworthy? It was not me who bared steel at Parley.
You write of defending Lord Robert even as you deny him food.
That must end. I am no warrior, but I will fight you if you do not lift this siege.
There are other lords besides you in the Vale, and King's Landing will send men as well. If it is war you want, say so now, and the Vale will bleed.
Elaine could see the doubt blooming in the eyes of the Lord's declarant.
A year is not so long a time,
Lord Redfort said uncertainly. Mayhaps, if you gave assurances.
None of us wants war,
acknowledged Lady Waynewood. Autumn wanes, and we must gird ourselves for winter.
Belmore cleared his throat. At the end of this year.
If I have not set the veil to rights, I shall willingly step down as Lord Protector, Peter promised them.
I called that more than fair,
Lord Nestor Royce put in.
There must be no reprisals, insisted Templeton. No talk of treason or rebellion. You must swear to that as well.
Gladly, said Peter. It is friends I want, not foes. I shall pardon all of you in writing if you wish. Even Lynn Corbray. His brother is a good man. There is no need to bring down shame upon a noble house.
Lady Waynewood turned to her fellow lords declarant. My lords, perhaps we might confer?
There is no need. It is plain that he has won. Bronzione's grey eyes considered Peter Baelish.
I like it not, but it would seem you have your year.
Best use it well, my lord. Not all of us are fooled.
He opened the door so forcefully that he all but wrenched it off its hinges. Later, there was a feast of sorts, though Peter was forced to make apologies for the humble fare. Robert was trotted out in a doublet of cream and blue, and played the little lord quite graciously. Bronzione was not there to see. He had already departed from the Eyrie to begin the long descent, as had Sir Lynn Corbray before him. The other lords remained with them till morn.
He bewitched them, Elaine thought as she lay abed that night, listening to the wind howl outside her windows. She could not have said where the suspicion came from, but once it crossed her mind it would not let her sleep. She tossed and turned, worrying at it, like a dog at some old bone. Finally she rose and dressed herself, leaving Gretchel to her dreams. Peter was still awake, scratching out a letter.
Elaine, he said, my sweet, what brings you here so late?
I had to know. What will happen in a year?
He put down his quill. Redfort and Waynewood are old. One or both of them may die. Gilwood Hunter will be murdered by his brothers, most likely by young Harlan, who arranged Lord Eon's death. In for a penny, in for a stag, I always say. Belmore is corrupt and can be bought. Templeton I shall befriend. Bronzione Royce will continue to be hostile, I fear, but so long as he stands alone, he is not so much a threat.
And Sir Lynn Corbray?
The candlelight was dancing in his eyes.
Sir Lynn will remain my implacable enemy. He will speak of me with scorn and loathing to every man he meets, and lend his sword to every secret plot to bring me down.
That was when her suspicion turned to certainty. And how shall you reward him for this service? Littlefinger laughed aloud. With gold and boys and promises, of course. Sir Lynn is a man of simple tastes, my sweetling. All he likes is gold and boys and killing.
Daenerys. In the centre of the Plaza of Pride stood a red brick fountain whose water smelled of brimstone, and in the centre of the fountain a monstrous harpy made of hammered bronze. 20 feet tall she reared. She had a woman's face with gilded hair, ivory eyes, and pointed ivory teeth. Water gushed yellow from her heavy breasts, but in place of arms she had the wings of a bat or a dragon. Her legs were the legs of an eagle, and behind she wore a scorpion's curled and venomous tail. The Harpy of Gis, Danny thought. Old Gis had fallen 5,000 years ago, if she remembered true, its legions shattered by the might of young Valyria, its brick walls pulled down, its streets and buildings turned to ash and cinder by dragon flame, its very fields sown with salt, sulphur, and skulls. The gods of Gis were dead, and so too its people. These Astapori were Mongols, Sir Jorah said. Even their Giscari tongue was largely forgotten. The slave cities spoke the high Valyrian of their conquerors, or what they had made of it. Yet the symbol of the old empire still endured here, though this bronze monster had a heavy chain dangling from her talons, an open manacle at either end. The harpy of Gis had a thunderbolt in her claws. This is the harpy of Astapor.
Tell the Westerosi whore to lower her eyes.
The slaver, Krasnys Monaklos, complained to the slave girl who spoke for him.
I deal in meat, not metal. The bronze is not for sale. Tell her to look at the soldiers. Even the dim purple eyes of a sunset savage can see how magnificent my creatures are, surely.
Krasny's high valerian was twisted and thickened by the characteristic growl of Gis, and flavoured here and there with words of slaver Argo. Danny understood him well enough, but she smiled and looked blankly at the slave girl, as if wondering what he might have said.
The good master Klasnes asks, are they not magnificent?
The girl spoke the common tongue well, for one who had never been to Westeros. No older than 10, she had the round, flat face, dusky skin, and golden eyes of Naith. The peaceful people, her folk were called, all agreed that they made the best slaves. They might be adequate to my needs, Danny answered. It had been Ser Jorah's suggestion that she speak only Dothraki and the common tongue while in Astapor. My bear is more clever than he looks. Tell me of their training.
The Westerosi woman is pleased with them, but speaks no praise to keep the price down,
the translator told her master.
She wishes to know how they are trained.
Krasny's Monaklos bobbed his head. He smelled as if he had been bathed in raspberries, this slaver, and his jutting red-black beard glistened with oil. He has larger breasts than I do, Danny reflected. She could see them through the thin, sea-green silk of the gold-fringed toka he wound about his body and over one shoulder. His left hand held the toka in place as he walked, while his right clasped a short leather whip.
Are all Westerosi pigs so ignorant? He complained. All the world knows that the Unsullied are masters of spear and shield and short sword.
He gave Danny a broad smile.
Tell her what she would know, slave, and be quick about it. The day is hot.
That much at least is no lie. A matched pair of slave girls stood behind them, holding a striped silk awning over their heads. But even in the shade, Danny felt light-headed, and Krasny's was perspiring freely. The Plaza of Pride had been baking in the sun since dawn. Even through the thickness of her sandals, she could feel the warmth of the red bricks underfoot. Waves of heat rose off them, shimmering, to make the stepped pyramids of Astapor around the plaza seem half a dream. If the Unsullied felt the heat, however, they gave no hint of it. They could be made of brick themselves, the way they stand there. 1,000 had been marched out of their barracks for her inspection, drawn up in 10 ranks of 100 before the fountain and its great bronze harpy. They stood stiffly at attention, their stony eyes fixed straight ahead. They wore naught but white linen clouts knotted about their loins, and conical bronze helms topped with a sharpened spike 1 foot tall. Krasnys had commanded them to lay down their spears and shields and doff their sword belts and quilted tunics, so the Queen of Westeros might better inspect the lean hardness of their bodies.
They are chosen young for size and speed and strength, the slave told her. They begin their training at 5. Every day they train from dawn to dusk until they have mastered the short sword, the shield, and the 3 spears. That training is most rigorous, Your Grace. Only one boy in Hlee survives it. This is well known. Among the Unsullied, it is said that on the day they win the spiked cap, the worst is done with, for no duty that will ever fall to them could be as hard as their training.
Krasys Monaklos supposedly spoke no word of the common tongue, but he bobbed his head as he listened, and from time to time gave the slave girl a poke with the end of his lash.
"Tell her that these have been standing here for a day and a night with no food nor water. Tell her that they will stand until they drop, if I should command it. And when 999 have collapsed to die upon the bricks, the last will stand there still and never move until his own death claims him. Such is their courage. Tell her that."
"I call that madness, not courage," said Austin Whitebeard, when the solemn little scribe was done.
He tapped the end of his hardwood staff against the brick, tap, tap, as if to tell his displeasure. The old man had not wanted to sail to Astapor, nor did he favor buying the slave army. A queen should hear all sides before reaching a decision. That was why Danny had brought him with her to the Plaza of Pride, not to keep her safe. Her blood riders would do that well enough. Sir Jorah Mormont she had left aboard Beleriand to guard her people and her dragons. Much against her inclination, she had locked the dragons below decks. It was too dangerous to let them fly freely over the city. The world was all too full of men who would gladly kill them for no better reason than to name themselves Dragon Slayer.
"What did the smelly old man say?"
the slaver demanded of his translator. When she told him, he smiled and said,
"Inform the savages that we call this obedience. Others may be stronger or quicker or larger than the Unsullied. Some few may even equal their skill with sword and spear and shield, but nowhere between the seas will you ever find any more obedient."
"Sheep are obedient," said Austin, when the words had been translated. He had some Valerian as well, though not as much as Danny, but like her, he was feigning ignorance. Krasny's Monaklos showed his big white teeth when that was rendered back to him.
"A word from me, and these sheep would spill his stinking old bowels on the bricks," he said. "But do not say that. Tell them that these creatures are more dogs than sheep. Do they eat dogs or horse in the Seven Kingdoms?"
"They prefer pigs and cows, your worship."
"Beef, pech, food for unwashed savages."
Ignoring them all, Danny walked slowly down the line of slave soldiers. The girls followed close behind with a silk awning to keep her in the shade, but the 1,000 men before her enjoyed no such protection. More than half of them had the copper skins and almond eyes of Dothraki and Lazarine, but she saw men of the free cities in the ranks as well, along with the pale Carthine, ebon-faced summer islanders, and others whose origins she could not guess. And some had skins of the same amber hue as Krasny's Monaklos, and the bristly red-black hair that marked the ancient folk of Gis who named themselves the Harpy's Sons. They sell even their own kind. It should not have surprised her. The Dothraki did the same when Khalasar met Khalasar in the Sea of Grass. Some of the soldiers were tall, and some were short. They ranged in age from 14 to 20, she judged. Their cheeks were smooth, and their eyes all the same, be they brown or black or blue or grey or amber. They are like one man, Danny thought, until she remembered they were no men at all. The Unsullied were eunuchs, every one of them. "Why do you cut them?" she asked Krasnys through the slave girl. "Whole men are stronger than eunuchs, I've always heard."
"A eunuch who is cut young will never have the brute strength of one of your Westerosi knights, that is true," said Krasny's Monaklos when the question was put to him. "A bull is strong as well, but bulls die every day in the fighting pits. A girl of 9 killed one not 3 days past in Jathel's pit. The Unsullied have something better than strength, tell her. They have discipline. We fight in the fashion of the old empire, yes. They are the lockstep legions of old Gis come again. Absolutely obedient, absolutely loyal, and utterly without fear.
Danny listened patiently to the translation. Even the bravest men fear death and maiming, Austin said when the girl was done. Krasny smiled again when he heard that.
Tell the old man that he smells of piss and needs a stick to hold him up.
Truly, your worship?
He poked her with his lash.
No, not truly. Are you a girl or a goat to ask such folly? Say that unsullied are not men. Say that death means nothing to them, and maiming less than nothing.
He stopped before a thick-set man who had the look of a Lazar about him, and brought his whip up sharply, laying a line of blood across one copper cheek. The eunuch blinked and stood there bleeding.
Would you like another?
Asked Krasny's. If it please your worship. It was hard to pretend not to understand. Danny laid a hand on Krasny's arm before he could raise the whip again. Tell the good master that I see how strong his unsullied are and how bravely they suffer pain. Krasny chuckled when he heard her words in Valyrian.
Tell this ignorant whore of a Westerner that courage has nothing to do with it.
The good master says that was not courage, your grace.
Tell her to open those slut's eyes of hers.
He begs you to attend this carefully, your grace.
Krasny moved to the next eunuch in line, a towering youth with the blue eyes and flaxen hair of lice.
Your sword, he said.
The eunuch knelt, unsheathed the blade, and offered it up hilt first. It was a short sword, made more for stabbing than for slashing, but the edge looked razor sharp.
Stand,
Krasny commanded. Your worship? The eunuch stood, and Krasny's monoclus slid the sword slowly up his torso, leaving a thin red line across his belly and between his ribs. Then he jabbed the sword point in beneath a wide pink nipple and began to work it back and forth. What's he doing? Danny demanded of the girl as the blood ran down the man's chest.
Tell the cow to stop her bleating,
said Krasny, without waiting for the translation.
This will do him no great harm. Men have no need of nipples. Eunuchs even less so.
The nipple hung by a thread of skin. He slashed and sent it tumbling to the bricks, leaving behind a round red eye, copiously weeping blood. The eunuch did not move until Krasny offered him back his sword, hilt first.
Here, I've done with you.
This one is pleased to have served you. Krasny turned back to Danny.
They feel no pain, you see.
How can that be? She demanded through the scribe.
The wine of courage,
was the answer he gave her.
It is no true wine at all, but made from deadly nightshade, bloodfly lava, black lotus root, and many secret things. They drink it with every meal from the day they are cut, and with each passing year feel less and less. It makes them fearless in battle, nor can they be tortured. Tell the savage her secrets are safe with the unsullied. She may set them to guard her counsels and even her bedchamber, and never a worry as to what they might overhear. In Yankai and Marine, eunuchs are often made by removing a boy's testicles, but leaving the penis. Such a creature is infertile, yet often still capable of erection. Only trouble can come of this. We remove the penis as well, leaving nothing. The unsullied are the purest creatures on the earth.
He gave Danny and Arstan another of his broad white smiles.
I have heard that in the Sunset Kingdoms men take solemn vows to keep chaste and father no children, but live only for their duty. Is it not so?
It is, Arstan said when the question was put.
There are many such orders. The maesters of the citadel, the septons and scepters who serve the seven, the silent sisters of the dead, the king's guard, and the night's watch.
Poor things, growled the slaver after the translation. Men are not made to live thus. Their days are a torment of temptation. Any fool must see. And no doubt most succumb to their baser selves. Not so are unsullied. They are wed to their swords in a way that your sworn brothers cannot hope to match. No woman can ever tempt them, nor any man.
His girl conveyed the essence of his speech more politely.
There are other ways to tempt men besides the flesh,
Austin Whitebeard objected when she was done.
Men, yes, but not unsullied. Plunder interests them no more than rape. They are nothing but their weapons. We do not even permit them names.
No names? Danny frowned at the little scribe. Can that be what the good master said? They have no names?
It is so, your grace.
Krasnys stopped in front of a Gascari, who might have been his taller, fitter brother, and flicked his lash at a small bronze disc on the sword belt at his feet.
There is his name. Ask the whore of Westeros whether she can read Gascari glyphs.
When Danny admitted that she could not, the slaver turned to the unsullied.
What is your name?
He demanded.
This one is called Lord Flea, your worship.
The girl repeated the exchange in the common tongue.
And yesterday, what was it?
Black Lat, your worship.
The day before?
Blown Flea, your worship.
Before that?
This one does not recall, your worship. Blue Toad, perhaps, or Blue Worm.
Tell her all their names are such,
Krasnys commanded the girl.
It reminds them that by themselves they are vermin. The name discs are thrown in an empty cask at duty's end, and each dawn plucked up again at random.
More madness, said Austin, when he heard. How can any man possibly remember a new name every day?
Those who cannot are culled in training, along with those who cannot run all day in full pack, scale a mountain in the black of night, walk across a bed of coals, or slay an infant.
Danny's mouth surely twisted at that. Did he see, or is he blind as well as cruel? She turned away quickly, trying to keep her face a mask until she heard the translation. Only then did she allow herself to say, "Whose infants do they slay?"
To win his spike cap, an unsullied must go to the slave marts with a silver mark, find some wailing newborn, and kill it before its mother's eyes. In this way, we make certain that there is no weakness left in them.
She was feeling faint. The heat, she tried to tell herself. You take a babe from its mother's arms, kill it as she watches, and pay for her pain with a silver coin? When the translation was made for him, Krasny's monoclus laughed aloud.
What a soft, mewling fool this one is. Tell the whore of Westeros that the mark is for the child's owner, not the mother. The unsullied are not permitted to steal.
He tapped his whip against his leg.
Tell her that few ever failed that test. The dogs are harder for him, it must be said. We give each boy a puppy on the day that he is cut. At the end of the first year, he is required to strangle it. Any who cannot are killed and fed to the surviving dogs. It makes for a good, strong lesson, we find.
Austin Whitebeard tapped the end of his staff on the bricks as he listened to that. Tap, tap, tap. Slow and steady. Tap, tap, tap. Danny saw him turn his eyes away, as if he could not bear to look at Krasnys any longer. The good master has said that these eunuchs cannot be tempted with coin or flesh, Danny told the girl. But if some enemy of mine should offer them freedom for betraying me,
they would kill him out of hand and bring her his head. Tell her that,
the slaver answered.
Other slaves may steal and hoard up silver in hopes of buying freedom, but an Ansalid would not take it if the little mare offered it as a gift. They have no life outside their duty. They are soldiers, and that is all.
It is soldiers I need, Danny admitted.
Tell her it is well she came to Astapor, then. Ask her how large an army she wishes to buy.
How many Ansalid do you have to sell?
8,000, fully trained and available at present. We sell them only by the unit, she should know. By the 1,000 or the century. Once we sold by the 10, as household guards, but that proved unsound. 10 is too few. They mingle with other slaves, even freemen, and forget who and what they are.
Krasny's waited for that to be rendered in the common tongue, and then continued.
This beggar queen must understand such wonders do not come cheaply. A Yunkai and Marine slave swordsman can be had for less than the price of their swords, but Ansalid are the finest foot in all the world, and each represents many years of training. Tell her they are like Valyrian steel, folded over and over and hammered for years on end, until they are stronger and more resilient than any metal on earth.
I know of Valyrian steel, said Danny. Ask the good master if the Ansalid have their own officers.
You must set your own officers over them. We train them to obey, not to think. If it is witch she wants, let her buy scribes.
And their gear?
Sword, shield, spear, sandals, and quilted tunic are included, says Krasnus. And the spike caps, to be sure. They will wear such armor as you wish, but you must provide it.
Danny could think of no other questions. She looked at Arstan. You have lived long in the world, Whitebeard. Now that you have seen them, what do you say?
I say no,
Your Grace, the old man answered at once. Why? She asked. Speak freely. Danny thought she knew what he would say, but she wanted the slave girl to hear it, so Krasny's Monaclas might hear later.
My queen, said Arstan, there have been no slaves in the Seven Kingdoms for thousands of years. The old gods and the new alike hold slavery to be an abomination, evil. If you should land in Westeros at the head of a slave army, many good men will oppose you for no other reason than that. You will do great harm to your cause and to the honor of your house.
Yet I must have some army, Danny said. The boy Joffrey will not give me the Iron Throne for asking politely.
When the day comes that you raise your banners, half of Westeros will be with you,
Whitebeard promised.
Your brother Rhaegar is still remembered with great love.
And my father? Danny said. The old man hesitated before saying,
King Aerys is also remembered. He gave the realm many years of peace. Your Grace, you have no need of slaves. Magister Illyrio can keep you safe while your dragons grow, and send secret envoys across the narrow sea on your behalf, to sound out the High Lords for your cause.
Those same High Lords who abandoned my father to the Kingslayer and bent the knee to Robert the Usurper?
Even those who bent their knees may yearn in their hearts for the return of the dragons.
May, said Danny. That was such a slippery word, may, in any language. She turned back to Krasny's Monaclus and his slave girl. I must consider carefully. The slaver shrugged.
Tell her to consider quickly. There are many other buyers. Only 3 days passed. I showed these same unsullied to a Corsair king who hopes to buy them all.
The Corsair wanted only 100, your worship,
Danny heard the slave girl say. He poked her with the end of the whip.
Corsairs are all liars. He'll buy them all. Tell her that, girl.
Danny knew she would take more than 100 if she took any at all. Remind your good master of who I am. Remind him that I am Daenerys Stormborn, mother of dragons, the unburnt, true-born queen of the 7 kingdoms of Westeros. My blood is the blood of Aegon the Conqueror and of old Valyria before him. Yet her words did not move the plump perfume slaver, even when rendered in his own ugly tongue.
All Gis ruled an empire when the Valyrians were still fucking sheep,
he growled at the poor little scribe.
And we are the sons of the Harpy.
He gave a shrug.
My tongue is wasted wagging at women. Tch, east or west, it makes no matter. They cannot decide until they have been pampered and flattered and stuffed with sweetmeats. Well, if this is my fate, so be it. Tell the whore that if she requires a guide to our sweet city, Kresny's Monaclus will gladly serve her, and service her as well, if she is more woman than she looks.
A good Master Kresny's would be most pleased to show you Astapor while you ponder, your grace,
the translator said.
I will feed her jellied dog brains and a fine rich stew of red octopus and unborn puppy.
He wiped his lips.
Many delicious dishes can be had here, he says.
Tell her how pretty the pyramids are at night,
the slaver growled.
Tell her I will lick honey off her breasts. Or allow her to lick honey off mine, if she prefers.
Astapor is most beautiful at dusk, your grace,
said the slave girl.
The good masters light silken lanterns on every talus, so the pyramids glow with colored lights. Pleasure barges play the worm, playing soft music, and calling at the little islands for food and wine and other delights.
Ask her if she wishes to view our fighting pits,
Kresny's added.
Dukor's pit has a fine folly scheduled for this evening, a bear and 3 small boys. One boy will be rolled in honey, one in blood, and one in rotting fish. And she may wager on which the bear will eat first.
Tap, 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 Danny heard. Aston Whitebeard's face was still, but his staff beat out his rage.
Tap, tap, tap.
She made herself smile. I have my own bear on Beleriand, she told the translator, and he may well eat me if I do not return to him.
See,
said Kresnus when her words were translated.
It is not the woman who decides. It is this man she runs to, as ever.
Thank the good master for his patient kindness, Danny said, and tell him that I will think on all I learn here. She gave her arm to Aston Whitebeard to lead her back across the plaza to her litter. Aego and Jogo fell in to either side of them, walking with a bow-legged swagger. All the horse lords affected when forced to dismount and stride the earth like common mortals. Danny climbed into her litter, frowning, and beckoned Aston to climb in beside her. A man as old as him should not be walking in such heat. She did not close the curtains as they got under way. With the sun beating down so fiercely on this city of red brick, every stray breeze was to be cherished, even if it did come with a swirl of fine red dust. Besides, I need to see. Astapor was a queer city, even to the eyes of one who had walked within the house of dust and bathed in the womb of the world beneath the mother of mountains. All the streets were made of the same red brick that had paved the plaza. So, too, were the stepped pyramids, the deep-dug fighting pits with their rings of descending seats, the sulphurous fountains and gloomy wine caves, and the ancient walls that encircled them. So many bricks, she thought, and so old and crumbling. Their fine red dust was everywhere, dancing down the gutters at every gust of wind. Small wonder that so many Astapori women veiled their faces. The brick dust stung the eyes worse than sand. "Make way!" Jogo shouted as he rode before her litter. "Make way for the Mother of Dragons!" But when he uncoiled the great silver-handled whip that Danny had given him and made to crack it in the air, she leaned out and told him, "Nay." "Not in this place, blood of my blood," she said in his own tongue. "These bricks have heard too much of the sound of whips." The streets had been largely deserted when they set out from the port that morning, and scarcely seemed more crowded now. An elephant lumbered past with a latticework litter on its back. A naked boy, with peeling skin, sat in the dry brick gutter, picking his nose and staring sullenly at some ants in the street. He lifted his head at the sound of hooves and gaped as a column of mounted guard trotted by in a cloud of red dust and brittle laughter. The copper discs, sewn to their cloaks of yellow silk, glittered like so many suns, but their tunics were embroidered linen, and below the waist they wore sandals and pleated linen skirts. Bareheaded, each man had teased and oiled and twisted his stiff red-black hair into some fantastic shape, horns and wings and blades, and even grasping hands, so they looked like some troop of demons escaped from the seventh hell. The naked boy watched them for a bit along with Danny, but soon enough they were gone, and he went back to his ants and a knuckle up his nose. An old city, this, she reflected, but not so populous as it was in its glory, nor near so crowded as Carth or Pentos or Lice. Her litter came to a sudden halt at the cross street to allow a couple of slaves to shuffle across her path, urged along by the crack of an overseer's lash. These were no unsullied, Danny noted, but a more common sort of men, with pale brown skins and black hair. There were women among them, but no children. All were naked. Two Astapori rode behind them on white asses, a man in a red silk toga and a veiled woman in sheer blue linen, decorated with flakes of lapis lazuli. In her red-black hair, she wore an ivory comb. The man laughed as he whispered to her, paying no more mind to Danny than to his slaves, nor the overseer with his twisted, five-thonged lash, a squat, broad Dothraki who had the harpy and chains tattooed proudly across his muscular chest. "Bricks and blood," Bilt Astapor, Whitebread murmured at her side, "and bricks and blood her people." "What is that?" Danny asked him, curious. "An old rhyme a maester taught me when I was a boy. I never knew how true it was. The bricks of Astapor are red with blood of the slaves who make them."
"Well, I can well believe that," said Danny.
"Then leave this place before your heart turns to brick as well. Sail this very night on the evening tide."
"Would that I could," thought Danny.
"When I leave Astapor, it must be with an army, Sir Jorah says." "Sir Jorah was a slaver himself, your grace," the old man reminded her. "There are sellswords in Pentos and Myr and Tyrus you can hire. A man who kills for coin has no honour, but at least they are no slaves. Find your army there, I beg you."
"My brother visited Pentos, Myr, Bravos, near all the free cities. The magisters and archons fed him wine and promises, but his soul was starved to death. A man cannot sup from the beggar's bowl all his life and stay a man. I had my taste in Carth. That was enough. I will not come to Pentos, bowl in hand."
"Better to come a beggar than a slaver," Austin said.
"There speaks one who has been neither." Danny's nostrils flared. "Do you know what it is like to be sold, squire? I do. My brother sold me to Khal Drogo for the promise of a golden crown. Well, Drogo crowned him in gold, though not as he had wished, and I... My sun and stars made a queen of me. But if he had been a different man, it might have been much otherwise. Do you think